Aren't you a foreigner?
Technically, Sasha said, but I know my way around. They reached an intersection thronged with what had to be college students. Strange how they looked the same everywhere. Boys and girls in black leather jackets, riding on Vespas, lounging on Vespas, perching and even standing on Vespas. The density of Vespas made the whole square seem to vibrate, and the fumes of their exhaust worked on Ted like a mild narcotic. In the dusk, a chorus line of palm trees vamped against a Bellini sky. Sasha threaded her way among the students with brittle self-consciousness, eyes locked ahead. In a restaurant on the square, she asked for a window table and ordered their meal. Fried zucchini flowers, followed by pizza. Again and again she peeked outside at the youths on their Vespas. It was poignantly clear that she longed to be among them.
Do you know any of those kids?
Ted asked. They're students, she said dismissively, as if the word were a synonym for nothing.
They look about your age.
Sasha shrugged. Most of them still live at home, she said. I want to hear about you, Uncle Teddy. Are you still an art history professor?
By now you must be an expert.
Jarred once again by her memory, Ted felt the pressure that arose in him when he tried to talk about his work, a confusion about what could have driven him to disappoint his parents and rack up mountainous debt so he could write a dissertation claiming, in breathless, zealous tones that embarrassed him now, that Cézanne's distinctive brushstrokes were an effort to represent sound, namely, in his summer landscapes, the hypnotic chant of locusts.
I'm writing about the impact of Greek sculpture on the French Impressionists, he said, attempting liveliness, but it landed like a brick.
Your wife, Susan, Sasha said. Her hair is blonde, right?
Yes, Susan is blonde.
My hair used to be red.
It's still red,
he said.
Reddish.
But not like it was. She watched him, awaiting confirmation.
No.
There was a pause. Do you love her, Susan? This cool inquiry landed somewhere near Ted's solar plexus.
Aunt Susan,
he corrected her. Sasha looked chastened. Aunt.
Of course I love her,
Ted said quietly. Dinner arrived. Pizza draped in buffalo mozzarella, buttery and warm in Ted's throat. After a second glass of red wine, Sasha began to talk. She had run away from home with Wade, the drummer for the Pinheads, a band that seemed to require no introduction, who were playing in Tokyo. We stayed at the Okura Hotel, meaning fancy, she said. It was April, that's cherry blossom season in Japan, and every tree was covered with all these pink flowers, and businessmen sang and danced underneath them in paper hats. Ted, who had never been to the Far East or even Near East, felt a twist of envy. After Tokyo, the band had gone to Hong Kong. We stayed in a white high-rise on a hill with the most incredible view, she said. Islands and water and boats and planes.
So is Wade with you now? In Naples?
She blinked. Wade? No. He'd left her there, in Hong Kong, in the tall white building. She'd lingered in the apartment until its owner had asked her to leave. Then she'd moved to a youth hostel inside a building full of sweatshops, people asleep under their sewing machines, on piles of fabric scraps. Sasha relayed these details lightheartedly, as if it had all been a romp.
Then I made some friends, she said, and we crossed into China. Are those the friends you were meeting yesterday?
Sasha laughed. I meet new people everywhere I go, she said. That's how it is when you travel, Uncle Teddy. She was flushed, from the wine or maybe the pleasure of remembering. Ted waved for the bill and paid it. He felt leaden, depressed, The teenagers had dispersed into the chilly night. Sasha didn't have a coat.
Please wear my jacket,
Ted said, removing the worn, heavy tweed, but she wouldn't hear of it. He sensed that she wanted to remain fully visible in her red dress. The tall boots exaggerated her limp. After a walk of many blocks, they reached a generic-looking nightclub, whose doormen waved them listlessly inside. By now it was midnight.
Friends of mine own this place, Sasha said, leading the way into a tumult of bodies, fluorescent purple light, and a beat with all the variety of a jackhammer. Even Ted, no connoisseur of nightclubs, felt the tired familiarity of the scene, yet Sasha seemed enthralled.
Buy me a drink, Uncle Teddy, would you? She said, pointing at a ghastly concoction at a nearby table.
Like that, with a little umbrella.
Ted shoved his way toward the bar. Being away from his niece felt like opening a window, loosening an airless oppression. But what was the problem exactly? Sasha had been having a ball, seeing the world. Hell, she'd done more in 2 years than Ted had done in 20. So why was he so eager to escape her? Sasha had commandeered 2 seats at a low table, a setup that made Ted feel like an ape, knees jammed under his chin. As she hoisted the umbrella drink to her lips, the purple light leached into slivers of pale scar tissue on the inside of her wrist. When she set down the drink, Ted took her arm in his hands and turned it over. Sasha allowed this until she saw what he was looking at, then yanked her arm away.
That's from before, she said. In Los Angeles.
Let me see.
She wouldn't. And to his own surprise, Ted reached across the table and grasped her wrists in his hands, taking a certain angry pleasure in hurting his niece as he wrested them over by force. He noticed that her nails were red. She'd painted them this afternoon. Sasha relented, averting her eyes as he studied her forearms in the cold, weird light. They were scarred and scuffed like furniture.
A lot or by accident, Sasha said. My balance was really off.
You've had a bad time.
He wanted her to admit it. There was a silence. Finally, Sasha said,
I kept thinking I saw my father. Isn't that crazy?
I don't know.
In China, Morocco, I'd look across a room, bam, I saw his hair, or his legs.
I still remember the exact shape of his legs, or how he threw back his head when he laughed.
Remember, Uncle Teddy? How his laugh was kind of a yell?
I do, now that you say it.
I thought he might be following me, Sasha said, making sure I was okay. And then, when it seemed like he wasn't, I got really scared. Ted let go of her arms, and she folded them in her lap. I thought he could keep track of me because of my hair, but now it isn't even red.
I recognized you.
True. She leaned toward him, her pale face close to Ted's, sharp with expectation. Uncle Teddy, she said, what are you doing here? It was the question he'd been dreading, yet the answer slid from Ted like meat falling off a bone.
I'm here to look at art, he said. To look at art and think about art.
There, a sudden, lifting sensation of peace. Relief. He hadn't come for Sasha. It was true.
Art?
That's what I like to do,
he said, and smiled, remembering the Orpheus and Eurydice this afternoon.
That's what I'm always trying to do. That's what I care about.
In Sasha's face, there was a slackening, as if some weight she'd been bracing herself against had been removed. I thought you came to look for me, she said. Ted watched her from a distance. A peaceful distance. Sasha lit one of her Marlboros. After 2 drags, she squashed it out.
Let's dance,
she said, a heaviness about her as she rose from her seat. Come on, Uncle Teddy, taking his hand, herding him toward the dance floor, a liquid mass of bodies that provoked in Ted a frightened sensation of shyness. He hesitated, resisting, but Sasha hauled him in among the other dancers, and instantly he felt buoyed, suspended. How long had it been since he'd danced in a nightclub? 15 years? More? Hesitantly, Ted began to move, feeling hulking, bearish in his professor's tweed, moving his feet in some approximation of dance steps until he noticed that Sasha wasn't moving at all. She stood still, watching him. And then she reached for him, encircled Ted with her long arms, and clung to him so that he felt her modest bulk, the height and weight of this new Sasha, his grown-up niece who had once been so small, and the irrevocability of that transformation released in Ted a ragged sorrow, so his throat seized up and a painful tingling fizzed in his nostrils. He cleaved to Sasha, but she was gone, that little girl, gone with the passionate boy who had loved her. Finally, she pulled away. Wait here, she said, not meeting his eyes. I'll be right back. Disoriented, Ted hovered among the dancing Italians until a mounting sense of awkwardness drove him from the floor. He lingered near it. Eventually, he circled the club. She'd mentioned having friends there. Could she be talking to them somewhere? Had she gone outside? Anxious, foggy from his own drink, Ted ordered a San Pellegrino at the bar. And only then, as he reached for his wallet and found it gone, did he realize that she'd robbed him. Sunlight pried open his sticky eyelids, forcing him awake. He'd forgotten to close the blinds. It had been 5 o'clock by the time he'd finally gone to bed, after hours of helpless wandering and a series of lousy directions to the police station, after locating it finally and relaying his sad tale, minus the pickpocket's identity, to an officer with oiled hair and an attitude of pristine indifference, after the offer of a ride to his hotel, which was all he'd really been after, from an elderly couple he'd met at the station, whose passports had been stolen on the Amalfi ferry boat. Now Ted rose from bed with a throbbing head and rampaging heart. Phone messages littered the table. 5 from Beth, 3 from Susan, and 2 from Alfred. I lose, read one, in the broken English of the hotel clerk. Ted left them where he'd thrown them. He showered, dressed without shaving, drained a vodka at the minibar, and removed cash and another credit card from his room safe. He had to find Sasha now, today, and this imperative, which had seized him at no specific moment, assumed an immediacy that was the perfect inverse of his prior shirking. There were other things he needed to do: call Beth, call Susan, eat. But doing them now was out of the question. He had to find her. But where? Ted deliberated this question while downing 3 espressos in the hotel lobby, letting the caffeine and vodka grate in his brain like fighting fish. Where to look for Sasha in this sprawling, malodorous city? He reviewed the strategies he'd already failed to execute. Approaching dissolute kids at the train station and youth hostels, but no, no. He'd waited too long for any of that. Without a clear plan, he took a taxi to the Museo Nazionale and set off in what seemed the direction he'd walked yesterday after viewing the Orpheus and Eurydice. Nothing looked the same, but surely his state of mind could account for the difference, the tiny metronome of panic now ticking within him. Nothing looked the same, yet everything looked familiar. The stained churches and slanting crusty walls, the hangnail-shaped bars. After following a narrow street to its wriggling conclusion, he emerged onto a thoroughfare lined with a gauntlet of weary palazzi, their bottom floors gouged open to accommodate cheap clothing and shoe stores. A breeze of recognition fluttered over Ted. He followed the avenue slowly, looking right and left, until he caught sight of the yellow smiley face overlaying a palimpsest of swords and crosses. He pushed open the small rectangular door cut into a broad, curved entrance originally built to receive horse-drawn coaches, then followed a passageway into a cobbled courtyard, still warm from recent sunlight. It smelled of rotting melons. A bandy-legged old woman wearing blue knee socks under her dress bobbled toward him, her hair in a scarf.
"Sasha," Ted said into her faded, wet eyes. "American. Capelli Rossi."
He tripped on the R and tried again.
"Rossi,"
he said, rolling it this time.
"Capelli Rossi."
Realizing as he spoke that the description was no longer quite accurate.
"No, no," the woman muttered.
As she began to lurch away, Ted followed, slipped a $20 bill into her soft hand and inquired again, rolling the R this time without a hitch. The woman made a clicking noise, jerked her chin, and then, looking almost sad, gestured for Ted to follow her. He did, filled with disdain at how easily she'd been bought, how little her protection was worth. To one side of the front door was a broad flight of stairs, splotches of rich, Neapolitan marble still winking up through the grime. The woman began climbing slowly, clutching the rail. Ted followed. The second floor, as he'd been lecturing his undergraduates for years, was the Piano Nobile, where palace owners brandished their wealth before guests. Even now, lousy with molting pigeons and stuccoed with piles of their refuse, its vaulted arches overlooking the courtyard were splendid. Seeing him notice, the woman said,
"Bellissima, eh? Ecco, guardate."
And with a pride Ted found touching, she threw open the door to a big, dim room whose walls were stained with what looked like patches of mold. The woman pulled a switch, and a light bulb dangling from a wire transfigured the moldy shapes into painted murals in the style of Titian and Giorgione. Robust, naked women clutching fruit, clumps of dark leaves, a whisper of silvery birds. This must have been the ballroom. On the third floor, Ted noticed two boys sharing a cigarette in a doorway. Another lay asleep under a straggling assortment of laundry, wet socks and underwear pinned carefully to a wire. Ted smelled dope and stale olive oil, heard a mutter of invisible activity, and realized that this palazzo had become a rooming house. The irony of finding himself smack in the midst of the demi-monde he'd struggled to avoid amused Ted. "So here we are," he thought. At last. On the fifth and top floor, where servants once had lived, the doors were smaller, set along a narrow hallway. Ted's elderly guide stopped to rest against the wall. His contempt for her yielded to gratitude. What effort that $20 had cost her! How badly she must need it!
"I'm sorry," he said. "I'm sorry you had to walk so far."
But the woman shook her head, not understanding. She tottered partway down the hall and rapped sharply on one of the narrow doors. It opened and Ted saw Sasha, half asleep, dressed in a pair of men's pajamas. At the sight of Ted, her eyes widened, but her face remained impassive.
"Hi, Uncle Teddy," she said mildly.
"Sasha,"
he said, realizing only then that he, too, was breathless from the climb.
"I wanted to talk to you."
The woman's gaze jumped between them. Then she turned and walked away. The moment she rounded a corner, Sasha shut the door in his face.
"Go away," she said.
I'm busy.
Ted moved nearer the door, flattening his palm against the splintery wood. Across it, he felt the angry, frightened presence of his niece.
So, this is where you live,
he said. I'm moving someplace better.
When you've picked enough pockets?
There was a pause. That wasn't me, she said. That was a friend of mine.
You've got friends all over the place, but I never actually see them.
Go! Leave, Uncle Teddy!
I'd like to,
Ted said.
Believe me.
But he couldn't bring himself to leave, or even really move. He stood until his legs began to ache, then bent his knees and slid to the floor. It was already afternoon, and an aureole of musty light issued from a window at one end of the hall. Ted rubbed his eyes, feeling as if he might sleep.
Are you still there?
Sasha barked through the door.
Still here.
The door opened a crack, and Ted's wallet bounced on his head and dropped to the floor. Go to hell, Sasha said, and shut the door again. Ted opened the wallet, found its contents untouched, and replaced it in his pocket. Then he sat. For a long time, hours it seemed, he'd forgotten his watch. There was silence. Occasionally, Ted heard other disembodied tenants moving inside their rooms. He imagined he was an element of the palace itself, a sensate molding or step whose fate it was to witness the ebb and flow of generations, to feel the place relax its medieval bulk more deeply into the earth. Another year, another 50. Twice he stood up to let tenants pass, girls with jumpy hands and cracked leather purses. They hardly glanced at him. Are you still there? Sasha asked, from behind the door.
Still here.
She emerged from the room and locked the door quickly behind her. She wore blue jeans, a t-shirt, and plastic flip-flops, and carried a faded pink towel and a small bag.
Where are you going?
He asked, but she stalked down the hall without comment. 20 minutes later, she was back, hair hanging wet, trailing a floral smell of soap. She opened her door with a key, then hesitated. I mop the halls to pay for this room, okay? I sweep the fucking courtyard. Does that make you happy?
Does it make you happy?
He countered. The door shook on its hinges. As Ted sat, feeling the evolution of the afternoon, he found himself thinking of Susan. Not the slightly different version of Susan, but Susan herself, his wife. On a day many years ago, before Ted had begun folding up his desire into the tiny shape it had become. On a trip to New York, riding the Staten Island ferry for fun, because neither one of them had ever done it, Susan turned to him suddenly and said, "Let's make sure it's always like this." And so entwined were their thoughts at that point that Ted knew exactly why she'd said it. Not because they'd made love that morning, or drunk a bottle of Pouilly Fouissé at lunch, because she'd felt the passage of time. And then Ted felt it, too, in the leaping brown water, the scudding boats and wind, motion, chaos everywhere, and he'd held Susan's hand and said,
"Always. It will always be like this."
Recently, he'd mentioned that trip in some other context, and Susan had looked him full in the face and chimed, in her new, sunny voice,
"Are you sure that was me? I don't remember a thing about it,"
and administered a springy little kiss to the top of Ted's head. Amnesia, he'd thought. Brainwashing. But it came to him now that Susan had simply been lying. He'd let her go, conserving himself for what? It frightened Ted that he had no idea, but he'd let her go, and she was gone.
"Are you there?"
Sasha called, but Ted didn't answer. She threw open the door and peered out. "You are," she said, with relief. Ted looked up at her from the floor and said nothing. "You can come inside, I guess," she said. He hauled himself to his feet and stepped into her room. It was tiny. A narrow bed, a desk, a sprig of mint in a plastic cup filling the room with its scent. The red dress, hanging from a hook. The sun was just beginning to set, skidding over rooftops and church steeples and landing in the room through a single window by the bed. Its sill was crowded with what appeared to be souvenirs of Sasha's travels. A tiny gold pagoda, a guitar pick, a long, white seashell. In the middle of the window, dangling from a string, hung a crude circle made from a bent coat hanger. Sasha sat on her bed, watching Ted look at her meager possessions. He recognized, with merciless clarity, what he'd somehow failed to grasp yesterday, how alone his niece was in this foreign place, how empty-handed. As if sensing the movement of his thoughts, Sasha said, "I get to know a lot of people, but it never really lasts." On the desk lay a small stack of books in English, The History of the World in 24 Lessons, The Sumptuous Treasures of Naples. At the top, a worn volume entitled Learning to Type. Ted sat on the bed beside his niece and put his arm around her shoulders. They felt like birds' nests under his coat. The prickling sensation ached in his nostrils.
"Listen to me, Sasha," he said. "You can do it alone, but it's going to be so much harder."
She didn't answer. She was looking at the sun. Ted looked, too, staring through the window at the riot of dusty color. Turner, he thought. O'Keefe. Paul Klee. On another day, more than 20 years after this one, after Sasha had gone to college and settled in New York, after she'd reconnected on Facebook with her college boyfriend and married late, when Beth had nearly given up hope, and had two children, one of whom was slightly autistic, when she was like anyone, with a life that worried and electrified and overwhelmed her, Ted, long divorced, a grandfather, would visit Sasha at home in the California desert. He would step through a living room strewn with the flotsam of her young kids and watch the western sun blaze through a sliding glass door. And for an instant, he would remember Naples, sitting with Sasha in her tiny room, the jolt of surprise and delight he'd felt when the sun finally dropped into the center of her window and was captured inside her circle of wire. Now he turned to her, grinning. Her hair and face were aflame with orange light. "See," Sasha muttered, eyeing the sun. "It's mine."
Chapter 12. Great Rock and Roll Pauses by Allison Blake. May 14th and 15th, 2020-something. 1. After Lincoln's game. 2. In my room. 3. One night later. 4. The desert. Us. Sasha Blake equals mom. Lincoln Blake equals brother, age 13. Drew Blake equals dad. Allison Blake equals me, age 12. After Lincoln's game. 1. Walking to the car. Cool air, but you feel heat coming up from the earth, like from behind a person's skin. My arm around my brother's neck, skipping in the desert night. I think I feel it through my shoes, but do I? When kids say, "Good game, Link," I answer for him. When I crouch to touch the parking lot, it glitters like coal in the streetlight. "Allison, cars!" Mom yells, overreacting as usual. Annoying habit number 81. I was right. The ground is warm. I stand up, slowly, rolling my eyes. I know, Mom. Annoying habit number 48.
Adios, Sasha,
says Jason's mom, Christine.
Adios, Christine,
Mom answers.
See you tomorrow, Sash,
says Mark's mom, Abby.
See you tomorrow, Ab,
Mom answers.
Good night, Sasha,
says Dan.
Good night, Dan,
Mom answers. In the car. Me. Why do you have to repeat people's exact words when you say goodbye to them? Mom.
What are you talking about?
I tell her precisely what I'm talking about. Mom.
Any chance of easing up on the scrutiny, Allie?
Me. Not possible. Dad is working. Desert landscape. When I was little, there were lawns. Now, you need a lot of credits for a lawn, or else a turbine, which is expensive. Our house is next to the desert. 2 months ago, a lizard laid eggs in the sand by our deck. Mom and Lincoln and I sit at our picnic table, looking up at the stars. Mom makes sculptures in the desert out of trash and our old toys. Eventually, her sculptures fall apart, which is part of the process. Lincoln. He looks like Dad, but younger and skinnier. Right now, he's obsessed with rock songs that have pauses in them. A full rest is 4 beats long. A half rest is 2 beats. He knows more than grown-ups about certain things. Songs with Lincoln's comments. Bernadette by the Four Tops.
This is an excellent early pause. The voice tapers off, and then you've still got 1.5 seconds of total silence, from 2 minutes 38 seconds to 2 minutes 39 and a half seconds before the chorus kicks back in. You think, hey, the song didn't end after all, but then 26.5 seconds later, it does end.
Foxy Lady by Jimi Hendrix.
Another great early pause. 2 seconds long, coming 2 minutes 23 seconds into a 3 minute 19 second long song. But this one isn't total silence. We can hear Jimmy breathing in the background.
Young Americans by David Bowie.
This is a lost opportunity. Hell, it would have been so easy to draw out the pause after break down and cry to a full second, or two, or even three, but Bowie must have chickened out for some reason.
Dad versus Mom. Dad would say, if he were here,
wow, you've really analyzed those songs, Link. I admire you for digging into the minutia. You spend time with any other kids today?
Mom says,
I like Bernadette the best of those three. I don't think of Bowie as a chicken, so there must be some reason he opted not to pause there. Please don't say hell.
Now just the pauses. Lincoln loops the pause in each song so it lasts for minutes at a time. If my friends are around, I ignore Lincoln's music. When it's just us, the pauses are my favorite. They sound like this. Mom says,
there's a smokiness to the Bernadette pause, probably because it's recorded on 8-track. It's a little eerie to hear Hendrix snickering continuously. I'm not sure that qualifies as a true pause. God, it's a beautiful night. I wish your dad were here.
Why Dad isn't here. Doctor, today he operated on the heart of a girl younger than me. Her parents are illegal. Good man. That's what everyone says about Dad, because of his clinic. Boss. At work, people follow Dad around with questions. In his office, he'll shut the door with a giant sigh and say,
Alley Cat, tell me what you did today.
Weak point. He can't understand Lincoln. For example, Lincoln wants to say, slash, ends up saying,
I love you, Dad.
Dad is from Wisconsin. I love music. Dad loves me. Steve Miller is from Wisconsin. The Steve Miller Band was popular 50-something years ago. One of their biggest hits was Fly Like an Eagle.
Hey, Dad, there's a partial silence at the end of Fly Like an Eagle, with a sort of rushing sound in the background that I think is supposed to be the wind, or maybe time rushing past.
Good to know, Link,
Dad says. What I notice during the looped pauses. A whisper of orange on the horizon. 1,000 black turbines. Miles of solar panels like a black ocean I've never seen close up. You can't get used to the stars, no matter how long you live here. There was a desert in Pakistan, but I don't remember it. All I remember is this. In my room. 2. Annoying habit number 92. Mom, seeing me making slides.
Again?
Me. So? Mom.
Why not try writing for a change?
Me. Excuse me, this is my slide journal. Mom.
I mean writing a paper.
Me. Ugh. Who even uses that word? Mom.
I see a lot of white. Where does the writing come in?
Slide slogans from school that I fire at Mom, just to annoy her. Give us the issues, not the tissues. A word wall is a long haul. Add a graphic and increase your traffic. Charts should illuminate, not complicate.
Please, Allie, have mercy,
Mom says, but she's laughing. Mom spots the toy horse. I keep it on my windowsill. It's made of apricot shells. She and Dad got it when they lived in Pakistan. Mom told me once,
we thought our baby might play with that horse.
After Dad and Mom found each other again, she packed up her life in New York and met him overseas.
I never looked back,
she says. I still play with the horse sometimes, alone in my room, even though I'm 12. I like to make the prediction come true.
Oh, Allie, I love seeing that horse,
Mom says. What about this? I ask and open the book. Conduit. A Rock and Roll Suicide by Jules Jones. Mom bought the book, but she never mentions it. It's about a fat rock star who wants to die on stage, but ends up recovering and owning a dairy farm. There's a picture of Mom on page 128. Sasha in the picture. She looks like someone I want to know, or maybe even be. Her face is sharp and pretty. Like a fox. Her hair is bright red and tangled. She's on the street with some people, including the rock star, before he got fat. The caption is, Outside the Pyramid Club, early 1990s. Mom's mouth is smiling, but her eyes are sad. Mom's reasons for not talking about that time.
It feels like another life. I don't trust my memories. It's also imbued with my own struggles.
What struggles? I asked her once.
Nothing you need to think about,
Mom said. Lincoln's bed is on the other side of the wall from my bed. Two knocks from his side equals...
Good night, Allie.
Two knocks from my side equals... Good night, Link. Mom will go to his room next. I can hear them talking through the wall. Lincoln gets her longest. I get her first. Mom sits on the edge of my bed. I want to know every bad thing you've done, I say, including dangerous and embarrassing.
You can't,
Mom says. I stare at her until she looks away. What I suddenly understand. My job is to make people uncomfortable. I will do it all my life. My mother, Sasha Blake, is my first victim. Lincoln appears when I'm half asleep. He clamps his headset over my ears. On the display it says, Mighty Sword, by the Frames. Old music, I guess. Music first, and then the pause. I wait and wait and wait. Is that the end of the song? I finally ask. Lincoln starts to laugh, and I laugh too. He has a sweet, goofy giggle. There are freckles on his cheeks. How long can one pause go? I ask.
1:14,
Lincoln bellows. What is going on in here? She's holding a handful of little papers she makes into collages after we're asleep. Annoying habit number 22. I don't know why she loves junk so much.
Not junk,
Mom will say.
Tiny pieces of our lives.
She collages in her waiting chair in the living room. Usually when Dad's not home yet. Mom in the doorway.
Bedtime, kittens,
she says.
Back to your room, Link. It's a school night.
Mom's art. They come from our house and our lives.
Dinner party Langs, bring wine.
She uses found objects.
Pick up shoes. Buy Sharpies. Black.
She says they're precious because they're casual and meaningless.
1:18. Grapes, skim milk, Earl Grey tea, Drew shampoo, crazy glue, peanut butter, Rolaids.
But they tell the whole story if you really look.
Link, therapy, 2 p.m. Kids, call Grandma Blake. Eye appointment, 3:30 Wednesday.
She glues them onto boards and shellacks them.
Ali sleepover at Suzette, 9:19. Caring for your smart fan.
I look when she's not there.
Ada's pie crust, use lard. Mexico flight, confirmation number XJKD7877.
Ways it can be when Dad comes back. Kissing Mom, telling stories, laughing, wine cork popping. Sits in car before coming in, hugging Mom, silent, angry, gin pouring. Dad comes home late. I hear the brushing door through my sleep. I peek through my door slit. Mom has her arms around Dad. His face is in her hair. They don't say anything. There's a blanket on Mom's waiting chair where she fell asleep. One night later. 3. Dad barbecues chicken on the deck. His dinners are better than Mom's, even when they cook the same thing. We eat all together at the picnic table. Dad asks us about school, and I tell him. Mom keeps her arm around Dad and kisses the side of his face. Annoying habit number 62. I want to ask about the girl with the heart. Facts about Dad. Right after he shaves, his skin will squeak if you push your finger across it. His hair is thick and wavy, unlike a lot of dads. He can still lift me onto his shoulders. When he chews, I hear his teeth smash together. They should be in pieces, but they're strong and white. When he can't sleep, he walks into the desert. It's a mystery why he loves Mom so much. Dad's laugh. It's hard to make Dad laugh. When he does, it's a big sound, like a bark or a roar. Maybe the bark or roar is his surprise at laughing. Mom says Dad used to laugh more.
Everyone laughs more as a kid,
she says, including college. True story. When Dad was in college, he went swimming with a guy named Rob, and Rob drowned. That was when Dad decided to become a doctor. Why not become a lifeguard? I'll sometimes ask. Or a swim instructor.
Good point,
Dad says.
Think I still can?
Before that, Dad wanted to be president.
Who doesn't at 18?
He'll say. Dad will tell anyone this stuff.
Keeping secrets can kill you,
is one of his favorite sayings. Rob was Mom's best friend. She keeps his picture in her wallet. He's primordially cute, with reddish face stubble and nice eyes, like a mountain climber. Still, Dad is more handsome. If you look carefully, you can tell that Rob will die young. He has that look of someone who's only in old pictures. Did you love him? I asked Mom.
Yes, as a friend.
What was he like?
He was sweet and confused, like a lot of kids.
Why did he drown?
He wasn't a strong swimmer, and he got caught in a current.
Why couldn't Dad rescue him?
He tried.
Dad's questions / Lincoln's answers.
How did the game go the other night?
We lost 5-2.
How many at-bats did you have?
3.
Anything new at school today?
Nope.
Did you have music class with Mom?
Not today.
Any kids you feel like asking over to play?
I see them at school.
Want to have a catch after dinner?
I'd rather play music. Can I play music, Dad?
Signs that Dad isn't happy. His mouth is smiling, but his face is tired. He's on his second gin and tonic. He's rubbing his eyes.
Sure, Link,
he says, after dinner.
Let's hear some music.
Songs with Lincoln's comments. Long Train Runnin' by the Doobie Brothers.
The pause is only 2 seconds, from 2 minutes 43 seconds to 2 minutes 45 seconds, but it's basically perfect. The refrain comes back in, and then the song goes until 3 minutes 28 seconds. Even after the pause, you've got almost another full minute of music.
Super Vixen by Garbage.
This one is unique because the pauses happen when there's no rest in the music. They're just second-long interruptions from 14 seconds to 15 seconds, and again from 3 minutes and 8 seconds to 3 minutes and 9 seconds. It sounds like there's a gap in the recording, but it's intentional.
Dad to Mom, whispering under the music, but I can hear him.
Should we be encouraging this?
Of course we should.
How is this helping him connect to other kids?
It connects him to the world.
Why not try to divert him onto something else?
This is what he cares about right now.
But what is it, Sasha? What is this?
Drew, Mom says. It's music. Dad/Lincoln. Dad.
Lincoln, before you play another song, I'd love to know why the pauses matter so much to you.
Lincoln.
Roxanne has one. That old song by the Police? There's a pause from 1 minute and 57 seconds to 1 minute and 59.
Dad.
Okay, Link. But I'm asking you.
Lincoln.
In Rearrange Beds by Anne Horse, there's a 2-second pause from 3 minutes and 40 seconds to 3 minutes and 42 seconds. And unlike a lot of songs, where you basically know the song's not over, even though the pause makes you wonder if maybe it is, with Rearrange Beds, it really, truly sounds like...
Stop!
Dad shouts.
Stop, please. Forget I asked.
Lincoln starts to cry. His crying makes sounds like scraping. Hearing him cry makes me cry, too. Dad tries to hug Lincoln, but he flinches away and hunches his back into a ball. Mom's face is white and furious. She leans close to Dad and says very softly,
"The pause makes you think the song will end, and then the song isn't really over, so you're relieved. But then the song does actually end, because every song ends, obviously, and that time, the end, is for real."
A pause while we stand on the deck. Then Dad gathers Lincoln into his arms. Lincoln fights him, but Dad is stronger.
"Okay,"
Dad says softly.
"Okay, Link. I'm sorry."
They look so much alike. It's like watching Dad hug his skinny, long-ago self. Even when Lincoln stops struggling, he keeps sobbing. His shoulder blades jab through his shirt. Lincoln runs inside and slams his bedroom door. Mom follows him. I stay on the porch with Dad. The sunset is a bonfire over our heads. Dad drains his gin and tonic and shakes the bare ice.
"Feel like a walk, Allie?"
he asks. The desert. 4. It starts where our lawn used to be. 3 steps down from our deck, the desert surrounds us. Mountains like cut-out paper shapes. Big top sky, full of stars. Mom's sculptures, made of train tracks and doll heads, fading into the dust.
"Careful of snakes,"
Dad says. "It's too cold," I say. "They're sleeping."
"Let's keep it that way,"
Dad says. Sounds. The desert is quiet and busy. I hear faint clicks like the scratchy paws in Bernadette. There is a hum like the pause in Closing Time by Semisonic. The whole desert is a pause.
"I've got to do better with Lincoln,"
Dad says. Me. He needs help graphing the pauses. Dad.
"I could do that."
Me. "But will you really?" Dad.
"If I say I will, I will."
Me. "He's been asking me, but I'm terrible at graphing." Dad.
"I might have to brush up a little."
The old golf course. There are lots of grayish swells and dips, like the moon. The clubhouse is still there, roped off and collapsing. Dad stands in a shallow hole and grins at me.
"I remember this trap,"
he says. "You used to play here, right?" I ask. I remember riding the cart between purple flower beds.
"Sure. All doctors play golf."
Dad doesn't like most doctors.
"They're arrogant,"
he says. Dad doesn't have time for friends.
"You're the only friends I need,"
he'll say, meaning us. A long, empty stretch of walking. "Is Mom mad?" I ask.
"I believe she is."
"Will she forgive you?"
"Of course."
"How do you know?"
"Your mother is the forgiving type. Thank God."
"Did she forgive you when Rob drowned?" Dad stops walking and turns to me. The moon has just come up.
"What made you think of him?"
"Sometimes I just do."
"Me too,"
Dad says. After a long time, we reach the solar panels. I've never walked this far. The panels go on for miles. It's like finding a city or another planet. They look evil, like angled, oily black things. But they're actually mending the earth. There were protests when they were built years ago. Their shade made a lot of desert creatures homeless. But at least they can live where all the lawns and golf courses used to be. But it wasn't your fault, right?
It was no one's fault.
Dad says.
She died this morning.
Dad says. The girl from yesterday, I say, with the sick heart. Suddenly, there's a whirring noise around us. Thousands of solar panels lift and tilt at the same time, in the same way. I clutch at Dad's arm. Why are they doing that?
They're collecting moonlight,
Dad says, and I remember. It's weaker, but we use it. The panels shift and move. Is this where you come when you walk in the night? I ask. We stand a long time, watching the solar panels move. They remind me of robotic ninja warriors doing Tai Chi. I think I never want to go back home. I want to stay here forever with Dad. Dad holds my hand. Me/Dad. Have you heard of a group called The Frames?
I think your mom used to listen to them.
They have a song called Mighty Sword that has a pause of more than a minute. Dad stares at me.
Come on, Allie. Not you, too.
You have to admit, that's a long time for a song to pause. Suddenly, Dad laughs in his big, churning way.
You're right. That is a very long pause.
After a while, I feel like curling up on the ground and closing my eyes.
Brace yourself,
Dad says.
It's a long way back.
I wish I were already in bed, I say. We walk for several years. I start to think we won't make it. I'll never see Mom or Lincoln again. When our house finally comes into view, the windows are dark. Dad points to a snake on one of Mom's sculptures. It's coiled like a silver rope on my old puppet theater. Dad lifts me onto his shoulders. He's the strongest man in the world. He carries me toward our house. It looks abandoned, like the clubhouse at the golf course. Do you think they're inside? I ask. Dad doesn't answer. Suddenly, I'm scared. What I'm afraid of? That the solar panels were a time machine? That I'm a grown-up woman coming back to this place after many years? That my parents are gone, and our house isn't ours anymore. It's a broken-down ruin with no one in it. Living here all together was so sweet, even when we fought. It felt like it would never end. I'll always miss it. Dad sets me down on our porch. I run to the sliding glass door and yank it open. Inside, there's a light. Familiar things fall back over me, like the softest, oldest blanket. I start to cry. What I hear as I'm falling asleep.
Hey, Link.
Yeah?
You hear that sound?
No.
That.
No, Pop.
Here, let's stand by the window. Listen with me. What does that sound like to you?
Okay, I know. Relationship of pause length to haunting power. Long train running, Doobie Brothers. Pause length, 2 seconds. Pause power, 5. Bernadette, the Four Tops. Pause length, 5.5 seconds. Pause power, 5. Super Vixen, Garbage. Pause length, 1 second. Pause power, 4. Faith, George Michael. Pause length, 3 seconds. Pause power, 5. Young Americans, David Bowie. Pause length, 1. Pause power, 2. Good Times, Bad Times, Led Zeppelin. Pause length, 2. Pause power, 4. Please play this song on the radio. No effects. Pause length, 2 seconds. Pause power, 3. The Time of the Season, Zombies. Pause length, 2 seconds. Pause power, 5. Closing time, semisonic. Pause length, 3 seconds. Pause power, 5. Roxanne, police. Pause length, 2 seconds. Pause power, 5. Foxy Lady, Jimi Hendrix. Pause length, 2 seconds. Pause power, 4. Mighty Sword, frames. Pause length, 2 seconds. Pause power, 5. Rearrange beds, Ann Horse. Pause length, 3 seconds. Pause power, 5. Proof of the necessity of pauses. Long train running, pause power, 5. Song excellence, 5. Bernadette, pause power, 5. Song excellence, 5. Super Vixen, pause power, 4. Song excellence, 3. Faith, pause power, 5. Song excellence, 4. Young Americans, pause power, 2. Song excellence, 5. Good Times, Bad Times, pause power, 4. Song excellence, 3. Please play this song on the radio. Pause power, 3. Song excellence, 2. The Time of the Season. Pause power, 5. Song excellence, 5. Discoveries about pause timing. Long train running. Pause power, 5. Length of song, 3 minutes 28 seconds. Time remaining after pause, 43 seconds. Bernadette, pause power, 5. Length of song, 3 minutes, 6 seconds. Time remaining after pause, 26.5 seconds. Super Vixen, pause power, 4. Length of song, 3 minutes, 56 seconds. Time remaining after pause, 47 seconds. Faith, pause power, 5. Length of song, 3 minutes, 13 seconds. Time remaining after pause, 11 seconds. Young Americans, pause power, 2. Length of song, 3 minutes and 15 seconds. Time remaining after pause, 35 seconds. Good Times, Bad Times, pause power, 4. Length of song, 2 minutes, 47 seconds. Time remaining after pause, 44 seconds. Please play this song on the radio, pause power, 3. Length of song, 2 minutes, 17 seconds. Time remaining after pause, 32 seconds. The Time of the Season, pause power, 5. Length of song, 3 minutes, 34 seconds. Time remaining after pause, 59 seconds. Closing Time, pause power, 5. Length of song, 4 minutes, 34 seconds. Time remaining after pause, 75 seconds. Roxanne, pause power, 5. Length of song, 3 minutes, 9 seconds. Time remaining after pause, 70 seconds. Foxy Lady, pause power, 4. Length of song, 3 minutes and 19 seconds. Time remaining after pause, 54 seconds. Mighty Sword, pause power, 5. Length of song, 9 minutes and 33 seconds. Time remaining after pause, 197 seconds. Rearrange Beds, pause power, 5. Length of song, 4 minutes and 16 seconds. Time remaining after pause, 34 seconds. The Persistence of Pauses Over Time. Long Train Runnin', song year, 1973. Length of song, 3 minutes, 28 seconds. Number of pauses, 1. Bernadette, song year, 1967. Length of song, 3 minutes and 6 seconds. Number of pauses, 1. Super Vixen, song year, 1995. Length of song, 3 minutes, 56 seconds. Number of pauses, 2. Faith, song year, 1987. Length of song, 3 minutes, 13 seconds. Number of pauses, 1. Young Americans, song year, 1975. Length of song, 3 minutes, 15 seconds. Number of pauses, 1. Good Times, Bad Times, song year, 1969. Length of song, 2 minutes, 47 seconds. Number of pauses, 3. Please play this song on the radio. Song year, 1992. Length of song, 2 minutes, 17 seconds. Number of pauses, 1. The Time of the Season, song year, 1968. Length of song, 3 minutes and 34 seconds. Number of pauses, 4. Closing time. Song year, 1998. Length of song, 4 minutes and 34 seconds. Number of pauses, 1. Roxanne. Song year, 1978. Length of song, 3 minutes and 9 seconds. Number of pauses, 1. Foxy Lady. Song year, 1967. Length of song, 3 minutes and 19 seconds. Number of pauses, 1. Mighty Sword. Song year, 2001. Length of song, 9 minutes and 33 seconds. Number of pauses, 3. Rearrange Beds. Song year, 2008. Length of song, 4 minutes and 16 seconds. Number of pauses, 1. The end.
Chapter 13. Pure Language.
You don't want to do this,
Benny murmured.
Am I right?
Absolutely, Alex said.
You think it's selling out, compromising the ideals that make you, you.
Alex laughed.
I know that's what it is. See, you're a purist,
Benny said.
That's why you're perfect for this.
Alex felt the flattery working on him, like the first sweet tokes of a joint you know will destroy you if you smoke at all. The long-awaited brunch with Benny Salazar was winding down, and Alex's hyper-rehearsed pitch to be hired as a mixer had already flopped. But now, as they eyed each other from lean perpendicular couches doused in winter sun that poured from a skylight in Benny's Tribeca loft, Alex felt the sudden, riveting engagement of the older man's curiosity. Their wives were in the kitchen. Their baby daughters were between them on a red Persian carpet, warily sharing a kitchen set.
If I won't do it,
Alex said,
then I can't really be perfect. I think you will.
Alex was annoyed, intrigued.
How come? A feeling,
Benny said, rousing himself slightly from his deep recline.
That we have some history together that hasn't happened yet.
Alex had